budgetary review because
antibiotics now.
Let's open the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today's Tuesday, April 4th. And we've got a lot of people here. I'm not sure exactly how to guess which bill everyone's here on. Maybe Ag Heritage Program is a bunch of them. I see at least one cowboy hat. Let's see if we can thin the room out at all with some work sessions, like, for example, Farm to School, where people may be anxiously awaiting the outcome of that. I'm not sure. So let's open a work session on House Bill 2038. Colleagues, we heard this a long time ago. This is the Farm to School program, which has been officially in existence since 2008. It has been in the co-chair's budget reduced by about half of what it received last time. It's currently a statewide program with enough money to go to every school. The governor's budget had $0, period, at all for it. So we've gotten halfway up the hill. But we were not able to send it to Ways and Means earlier due to the admonition from the speaker to not just send things down there in February and be done with them. So for our Ways and Means members that are here, I think they appreciate that a little bit. And we're trying to prioritize in this committee, you know, what we send down there. So we'll have a talk. But my feedback from committee members has been that this one seems to be one worth sending on. We will have one potential issue in Ways and Means I might flag. If we don't end up with a statewide program level of funding, then the statute would probably need to be changed to go back to a competitive grant program, because we actually changed the statute that it goes across the board, but the funding level is sort of necessary for that to happen. Otherwise, it kind of becomes meaningless, where you get down to like the half a cent per meal range if you're not careful, and then it's not really worth it to do it as a statewide program, because no one school district will find that worth doing, and we'd want to switch it back. But let's hope that doesn't happen. So,
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 2/13/17.
Vice Chair McLean moves the Dash 2 amendments. Can you tell us what the Dash 2s do?
Sure. Chair Clem, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments exclude milk and bakery products from the non-competitive grant funding and expand the list of organizations that may be considered for competitive grants to provide agriculture-based or garden-based educational activities.
Thank you. I forgot to mention that part of it. So some of you have heard about Farm to School, which is where the schools receive money to help buy school lunches. The other part of the program is the school garden program, where there are grants made available to schools to have school gardens. And it really tends to help the kids want to eat the more fresh, wholesome food if they actually know how it's grown. And in particular, if they've grown some theirself, it tends to amplify the, I guess you could call it, the pickup rate in the lunchroom of kids if they have done some growing themselves. Okay, any discussion on these Dash 2s? Any objection? Dash 2s are adopted.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 2038 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair McLean, I should just read my script, moves House Bill 2038 is amended to the floor with due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion. I'm Representative Brocksmith. This is the Farm to School bill. Appropriates money, sending it to Ways and Means.
Thank you, sir.
Any discussion on Farm to School? Okay, seeing none. Any objections? Seeing that, off to Ways and Means we go. Best of luck. Farm to School advocates, go to Ways and Means. Sorry, Ways and Means co-chair. Okay. I need Rep. Springer here probably for the next one, so maybe we'll just go ahead and go into our public hearings. So, colleagues, we the other day just had a little bit of testimony on this bill because we had a lot of people here on the forest practices. But let me reopen a public hearing or open a public hearing on House Bill 3245. And Let me see how what we've got here. Did we lose all of our against people?
Well,
maybe I'll play the role of the against people because I feel bad they're now not here. But Tess, Lisa, and Chris, can you come up? And over the long weekend, some of us have probably forgotten even what this bill's about, so just kind of tell us again. I know it has to do with the Planning Commission, the City Council, and which decision is made at which level. But.
Great. Chair Clem, co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Tess Milio with the City of Salem supporting House Bill 3245. I just briefly wanted to thank our sponsors and talk about the amendment, the Dash 1 amendment that's on OLIS that the City of Salem supports. It is, you know, something that Rep. Helm helped us draft, and it makes two changes to the bill by narrowing the scope of this process to only address comprehensive plan maps, so not text amendments, and then it also makes sure that urban growth boundaries cannot be altered through this process. And we're planning to have future conversations with other stakeholders about any concerns that they have, some that you might have heard of last time. So I wanted to just say that and let Lisa talk, just briefly give you a high-level overview since we talked about it last time, but just touching back on it, and then we can answer any questions that you may have today.
Hi, good morning, Chair Clem, co-chairs, and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Anderson Ogilvie. I am the Interim Community Development Director for the City of Salem, and I appreciate you taking our time to talk about this bill today. I think it's really important that you remember that this just authorizes cities to implement this process, but doesn't require cities to designate this type of process to allow their Planning Commission to make this decision. Also, that counties have had this right since 1987, so this is a process that counties can do right now. And with our amendment, it does limit it to very specific type of applications, comprehensive plan map changes. So these are not broad public policy decisions. They're generally related to a specific development. And most of the time, they're coupled with other development applications. State law requires us to allow applicants to combine all their applications together for an efficient process. It's helpful to the public so that they can review the development in its entirety at one time instead of piecemeal. So most of the time, these types of applications include zone changes, site plan reviews, design review, etc. And not allowing the Planning Commission to make the final decision creates a weird situation where they decide 2, 3, 4 of the applications, and then 3 months later, the council decides the comprehensive plan map change because it has to go through the ordinance process. It slows down the review time. It's less efficient. It's confusing to the public about how they can appeal and when they can appeal. Allowing the Planning Commission to make this type of decision or hearings officer allows two opportunities for the public to weigh in because it allows a local appeal. And lastly, you've heard some concern about appeal fees. This bill doesn't affect appeal fees. If there's a concern about appeal fees, those exist today. And the appeal fees for land use applications affect many types of applications, and just allowing this minor change for this type of application does not change that problem or issue if it exists. Thank you for listening to my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Chris Crane. I'm the city attorney for the city of Happy Valley. I work for a firm, Beery, Elsner, and Hammond, that also represents about 15 other cities, counties, special districts as general counsel, and then special land use counsel for probably 30 or 40 other cities and counties. I also worked with legislative council, and I've worked with Multnomah Council. I've represented just about every level of state and local government. And I have to apologize. This bill is before you. It comes out of a LUBA decision that I was involved in recently. Had I maybe made better arguments, we wouldn't be here because, as was mentioned, all this bill does is grant authority to cities that was granted to counties 30 years ago when we were at LUBA, the opponents to the Happy Valley case that we were working on. I was working on argued based on some old county decisions, and LUBA said that you can't amend your comprehensive plan. The city has to, council has to amend the comprehensive plan. The Planning Commission can't do it. And they relied on some old county decisions, and LUBA said, well, that looks good to us. in the legislature 30 years ago then adopted ORS 215-431 that, if you look at it, is exactly the language of this bill. And granted, all it does is allow cities and – well, that statute allows counties. This bill would allow cities to assign decisions to the appropriate level of local government, whether it's the planning commission or the city council. The city of Happy Valley – the problem comes up because Happy Valley is one of few cities that their comprehensive plan map is the same map as their zoning map. They don't have two different maps. So every time they do a zone change, it's also a comp plan amendment. You know, the vast majority of cities in the state don't have this problem because they can do a zone change without it also being a comprehensive plan amendment. So this is a very small bill that just addresses those few jurisdictions and gives them the same authority that every other city in the county, the state has, and all of our 36 counties currently have. So it's a fairly small bill that just allows, again, the city council to assign decisions to the appropriate level of local government. I'll be specific because I know some of you have served on your board of county commissioners, some of you have served on city councils. Happy Valley, the code allows the planning commission to make the final decision on a zone change less than 20 acres. Anything larger than that, the city council has to make the decision. So they've reserved for themselves the policy authority over large zone changes. And that's a policy decision every local government will carve differently, right? But Happy Valley is also the fastest growing city in the state. We do a lot of zone changes. And with the demise of Damascus, we're going further east all the time. We do a lot of zone changes. So having to clog the city council's calendar with every one of these, no matter how small, is going to be a problem. And it's going to be expensive, which brings me to the appeal fee issue. Local governments have to balance their budgets just like the state. And if we can't charge appeal fees, I understand the concern about appeal fees. I sympathize. I wish we didn't have to have appeal fees or fees at all, but we're a fee and tax-based system of government anymore. And if we do away with appeal fees, the only way the cities can cover their costs is by cranking up application fees so high it's going to crush development. You have to be very careful. If you pull a string over here, you could unravel the sweater over there. This isn't a bill that has anything to do with appeal fees, and I don't want that red herring to distract from the core focus of the bill. If we want to have a discussion about appeal fees and how to finance state government, local government, we can have that discussion. I'd love to, frankly, but that isn't this bill. So I hope that nobody's distracted by this appeal fee issue. It's really not the focus of this bill, which is just a small bill that allows cities with a combined map to do zone changes without also having to send it to the city council. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Vice Chair McClain.
I think maybe it's for you, but when we talk about the difference between a zone map and a comprehensive plan map. Mm-hmm. The whole idea for a comprehensive plan is that a community is making a commitment that this is the kind of community they want and these are the kinds of zones they want. And so to me, comprehensive planning and zone planning are very connected. Mm-hmm. And so you indicated that there definitely was only a very small group of cities that have chosen to have a one map system. Mm-hmm. How many?
To be honest with you, I could tell you anecdotally of the cities I represent, Happy Valley is the only one, but I haven't done a statewide survey of all 200-plus cities.
Okay, then my other question is, and I don't want to talk about fees right now either, because mm-hmm. I think that is a different yeah. scenario, but the whole idea is review. It's review from neighbors to the community, you know, and so there's a difference if somebody decides to have an industrial zone or a different kind of a residential zone. Mm-hmm. You know, that makes a difference to the neighborhood who actually may have chosen to move there because of the way it was zoned at that time. So again, do you want to talk about the size of these changes, these zone changes?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McClain, happily, but with the caveat that it reflects only my experience. And again, every local jurisdiction is going to make these policy decisions differently and consistent with its own community values. You're right. The comp plan map is the community's expression of how it wants to grow, what it wants to look like. And you'll look at the comp plan map, and you'll see the green blob over here for industrial, the yellow over here for residential. And in most jurisdictions, that then gets shifted over to the zoning map. And that yellow blob for residential will get broken into high density or R5 or R3 or whatever. So you could, in most cities, go from R5 to R7 or R7 to R5 without amending your comp plan map because it's just one residential designation to another. But if you change your industrial to residential or commercial to industrial, that would amend your comp plan map, and that should be made at the community level. Happy Valley, with respect, within the zones, like within a residential zone, in the case I was involved in, we went from MUR, multi-use residential MC, to MURS. So it was one high-density residential zone to another, but because we have a single map system, it's also a comp plan amendment. So it was not a big change, but it was a zone change, which meant it was a comp plan amendment. And Lewis said, well, that's got to go to the city council. And the parcel in that case was less than 5 acres. It was small. And as I said, the city of Happy Valley made the policy choice that anything smaller than 20 acres, the Planning Commission is well positioned and well educated enough to make those decisions. Anything larger than 20 acres, the code requires the city council to make the final decision. So that's how Happy Valley decided that issue. I don't know how other cities have done that, but I do know that a lot of cities have delegated to their Planning Commission, Salem, for example, authority to approve zone changes. But as long as it doesn't amend the comp plan. If a comp plan amendment has to be approved by the city council in Salem and in almost every jurisdiction I'm aware of.
Where's the power?
Both of the cities that I represent have expressed some concerns. They currently only allow their elected accountable officials to make final decisions. Mm-hmm. And delegating this authority to the Planning Commission is not something that they're necessarily in favor with. And I do think the issue of fees is relevant to our discussion today because we'd be creating another level of appeal at the local level. So I am curious if your planning commissions are the final arbiter and it can be appealed to the city council and then would need to be appealed again to, say, LUBA, what is the ballpark fee that we're expecting local citizens to incur if they want to challenge these things?
If I may, and then Chair Clam, Representative Power. First of all, this bill doesn't require your cities, to do anything.
That.
They could continue their current system of having all zone changes approved by the city council, so there wouldn't be an appeal. It wouldn't change anything. It just authorizes cities to do that if they wish, consistent with their policy judgment. And this, again, isn't creating a new appeal system. Happy Valley has operated under this system for I've been advising them for 10 years, and it was in place before then. So this is not a new appeal process or system. And in the city of Happy Valley, the fee is $1,000 with a it's actually $2,500, but the extra $1,500 is a deposit. And if it's not spent, you get it back. And again, these appeals are not free. I mean, ask Representative Helm, who's a hearings officer, how much he charges local governments to hear an appeal. And the city has to pay him, and they have to pay their staff for these appeal hearings, and they've got to recover those costs somehow. So I can only tell you the few cities I work with what their appeal fee is. I don't know if there's a general appeal fee. I'll have to defer to my colleagues at LOC.
Chair Clem, Representative Power. In the city of Salem, I will just point out that for at least the last 30 years, the council has allowed the Planning Commission to be the final authority on comprehensive plan map changes. And so just this last year, because of the Happy Valley, we've had to change that. Our appeal fees are $268. We allow the Neighborhood Association to appeal for free, and the city council has the opportunity to call up any case they want and have their own appeal on it without somebody actually appealing it. So they're very reasonable, but we don't do cost recovery. Obviously.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, any more questions? Okay. I will say that I do think that the fee issue is largely unrelated because I've had it come up many, many times in many different bills, not just this bill. But I also will say that I don't think it's totally unrelated because this would be potentially something that if the council decided to start charging, or if the city decided to start charging for something that previously hadn't been, that is new. And I know that the issue from the past bills I worked on seemed to be there's, on the development side on these appeals, a limit in having it be enough that nuisance appeals aren't filed over and over. And on the city side, sometimes they're running their whole building departments off of these kinds of fees, which I don't think is appropriate either. And so you're getting, I think in, I don't remember if it was Bend or Deschutes County, but the issue before came up two sessions ago, and it was like $10,000 for a fee somewhere. And when we asked, it was like, that's the only reason our building department exists, is because we're tagging on. And I don't think it was an appeal fee for this particular type of appeal, but it was something else. And I remember it was Jonathan Manton on one end and somebody, and we almost had a deal where it was like, let's put a floor and a ceiling. And so it's got to be enough that it's only, you know, non-nuisance type appeals, but it can't be the whole building department either. So I'm not sure where we're going to go with this bill from here, but I won't say the fee issue is completely out of the question in terms of some kind of cap for this particular thing. Vice Chair McLean.
I just had one other issue, because it's been mentioned many times that, you know, this is exactly what the county has already. And I want to think about, and I want you guys, if you have expressions on this, to add them. But the county planning and the city planning, you know, looks very different in many places, because counties aren't often wanting to urbanize something and take on infrastructure costs and infrastructure responsibility. And actually, in the Tri-County area, the counties aren't going to be doing that anymore. You have to be a city, and you have to come with a comprehensive plan to be able to make any changes and to urbanize, as you well know. And so I guess I want, you know, it has to be a city that comes with that comprehensive plan. And so I guess I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, statewide and, you know, the urban areas, why a county and a city would need the same responsibility or the same level, or the, you know, there's a difference between a county planning board and a city county planning board.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean. Yes, I understand the goal in the metro area is to have all of the urban planning done by the cities. I also know that goal is some distance away from where we are now. We're the hearings our firm's the hearings officer for Washington County. I also represent City of Hillsborough, so I'm familiar with those issues. And representing Happy Valley and Clackamas County and Washington County are both in the urban planning business and will be for some time. I understand the goal, but we're not there yet. And then if you add in Lane County, Deschutes County, Linn County, other counties out there are trying to get out of the urban planning business, but they're still in it. And the converse of the question, why should city and county planning procedures be the same? The converse of that is, why should they be different, right? Maybe there are reasons, but they're going to vary by county, and they're going to vary by city. And so it makes it very difficult to establish a single statewide system. We heard that the City of Salem's appeal fee is $250, and Happy Valley is $2,500. I don't know what it is in different cities. You've got entire planning departments paid by appeal fees, and others, there's no cost recovery at all. So a single statewide answer to this question is going to be very difficult to achieve. And I guess my admonition is that there needs to be some deference to the local elected officials to make these policy decisions for their communities. Everybody, and you've heard, I'm sure, and keep in mind, cities and counties get pushed from both directions. Nobody likes paying appeal fees, and neighbors need to be able to have their voice heard. I understand that, but we get pushed by developers on the other side who complain about the application fees. And if we get away from appeal fees, I can guarantee you what that's going to have an effect, an adverse effect on application fees. They're going to go up, and it doesn't matter whether it's D.R. Horton building a housing complex or whether it's affordable housing, Bienville building affordable housing, or a church wants to add on to their day school. Those application fees are going to go up, and then you're going to hear about why are the application fees so high. We've got to have a meaningful conversation about how we pay for our planning program, and again, I would argue that this is not the bill for that.
Okay, let's move on to our other witnesses. Oh, was there questions? Okay, thank you. Aaron Doyle and John Chandler. And I forgot who it was I cut so short the other day. I thought it was Mary Kyle, but maybe Meredith, you know. Okay, all right. Aaron.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I wanted to reiterate a couple of points and then talk a little bit about appeals fees, since they seem to be popular despite the fact we don't want them. This is, in my assessment, a simple bill that provides an option for local governments to determine how to best engage their citizens. When you're looking at a comprehensive application, all of it's going to be heard at the Planning Commission level. There are requirements for notice. There are ways that the public has to participate. And then if the city is deciding to have this decision, this limited decision, added to that list of things that the Planning Commission is making that final decision on, there is an opportunity to engage your elected officials at the City Council, either through an appeal or through other ways that all of our city councilors tend to be available to the public, like going to the grocery store or living in their neighborhoods. They hear about these things. And so the City Council is aware of that public process that needs to take place, and they will hear from their constituencies if they aren't making it a public process that the public feels that they can engage in and understand. Overall, this bill is seeking to help a couple of cities that have been doing something for a long time that they thought they had the authority to do, and then it, as often happens, the court informs us, no, you're wrong. And we thought after 40 years that probably we were right. So this brings us in parity with how the counties were handling things and allows these couple of cities. We have done outreach to try and determine if there are other cities that were directly impacted or were aware of the Happy Valley decision. And Happy Valley and Salem were the ones that felt that this was going to impact their process. So I do think it's also a fairly narrow bill. I doubt that more cities are going to turn around and be like, ooh, we should do this, because they've been doing things at the City Council level. That's the decision that they had made. There are, in fact, cities that don't even have planning commissions. They can't find the volunteers to do it, or they don't have the number of applications that make it necessary. So having local jurisdictions make those decisions about how their communities interact with their government officials and which types of experts they're talking to. Planning commissioners focus on planning. They get trained on planning. They deal with the planner. The City Council deals with a lot of issues, and if you have all this planning work done at the Planning Commission and then this one issue being decided at the City Council, they're not necessarily hearing everything that's been made to make the decision necessary to do this comprehensive plan map amendment. So I think it's a good use of resources. As to the issue of appeals fees, this has been an ongoing discussion between a number of groups and local government. It's some days it's all about the counties, some days it's all about the cities. It depends upon which appeals and which groups you're talking about. The bigger question of appeals fees comes up because we are allowed to do cost recovery at the appeals fee level for most appeals fees for the bigger decisions, and some cities have made the decision that they will recover some or all of their costs. Others set a very low fee, and it varies greatly between the 241 jurisdictions that we represent. And many of the counties, in fact, and I probably shouldn't be speaking for the counties, but I've sat in enough of these meetings, many of the counties do full cost recovery because it's the only way they can afford to have a functioning planning counter, a functioning planning commission, and county board. And if we want to talk about amending how we pay for all of this, it's either going to be, as Mr. Crean said, on the backs of the application fee, which I believe Mr. Chandler will probably want to talk about, or it'll have to come in some other much larger revenue discussion related to how we do funding of local government. I can get on a soapbox about how we, but you don't want me to. I saw the chair look up when I said that. But if we're going to talk appeals fees and how we recover costs for doing the planning that we're required to under the land use planning system, we're going to have a more comprehensive conversation about what it means to be a local government and pay for the services we provide. After that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I had a 45-minute PowerPoint on this bill, but now I'm going to substitute my 45-minute PowerPoint on how come application fees are too high. on this base bill, honestly, I was blissfully unaware, at the risk of jeopardizing my status as a good member of the Oregon State Bar, I don't keep up with court cases. I could have sworn that this bill was unnecessary because this is how we did stuff. The city councils had the ability to tell their planning commissions, go ahead and use zone map changes, which is how we did things until 2016 when LUBA decided that wasn't the case. In my mind, this bill just takes us back to how most of us thought business was going forward, and those of us like me who don't stay current on the LUBA caseload thought it still was the case. It's a fairly narrow bill. It addresses, I think, a couple situations you already heard about. It makes sense to me to put it back the way it was working fine until LUBA said it wasn't. Now we can say, yes, it was, relax, it'll be fine again. I think the bill with the amendment makes sense. Narrowing it down a little bit helps address some of the concerns. On the issue of fees, I'm not going to belabor that one at all, other than, as has already been said, that is a conversation long overdue, how we pay for state services, municipal services, applicants, appellants, neighbors, et cetera. That is a desperately needed conversation. Cities are doing the best they can. Counties are doing the best they can. We reserve the right to go and squawk at them when we think they don't do it right. But they really, given the number of tools available to them or lack thereof, about the only system that works is to figure out some balance decided at the local level between how much you pay at the application side and how much you pay for the appeals locally. It is a mess. It should be unmessed at the first opportunity. As has been said, though, I doubt this bill is the right vehicle for that conversation. Be glad to take any questions. Good bill should pass. Thank you very much.
Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, have you ever built a PowerPoint?
Yes, ma'am.
Let alone a 45-minute one?
Trouble is,
that was a yes, no.
When I do PowerPoints, the shiny things keep it distracting me, and it takes me a lot longer.
Any other hot questions? Okay. Thank you. And Peggy Lynch, are you around anywhere?
I can't see him running PowerPoint.
No. Okay. Well, I think her issue is summarized in writing as well. So I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3245 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3249. And apparently I'm talking. And Kelly Beamer, come on up. But is Kelly with me? Oh. Well, I'm not going to go down there, but I'll just comment briefly on this bill. This was a project that was worked on by a lot of people who are going to talk today. I don't think legislators generally were involved, but when we know a good idea and want to steal it and claim it for our very own, we sometimes take what was requested to be a committee bill and say, wait a minute, can I put my name on that? And then ask a bunch of you to put your names on it. So I didn't do any work at all to get it this far. So if it's good, credit them. If it's bad, you could blame me for not doing any work. But I will say this. We have had a series of challenges, as Amanda knows, over the last 5 or 6 sessions trying to find some common ground between land conservation folks and farmers. And this was what I always thought would be the common ground. I just didn't know if we were actually going to get here. And the idea is that land that is continuing to be in agricultural hands from generation to generation is a really good form of conservation compared to, for example, a shopping mall. Paving it over and putting something else that's not related to ecosystem services or growing food for people is a good form of conservation. So these working lands easements that do exist voluntarily for growers to say, we're going to keep this in our family and keep these agriculture, I thought was a really positive way to try and promote conservation through continuing to have working lands. We used to have quite a few bills about conditional use on wetlands and all these other things, and this is where I was hoping we would end up. It appears for the moment, at least, maybe we are. So can you just get us started, Kelly, telling us about this bill?
Absolutely. I do have a PowerPoint I'm hoping to refer to. So thank you very much. For the record, my name is Kelly Beamer. I'm the executive director of the Coalition of Oregon Land Trusts. Thank you very much, Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, and committee members for having us here today and hearing this, hearing more about the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Program. I'm here representing the work group, the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Work Group, and I just want to spend a few minutes giving you just a brief history of the program and a little overview about how it works. Because I think, as Chair Clem referenced, it's not every day that you have this collection of organizations on the same page supporting a program and moving forward together. So it's quite exciting. A little bit about the work group. We were brought together in November of 2015 by Governor Kate Brown and also the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. The work group includes six statewide organizations that literally represent thousands of landowners across Oregon regarding agriculture and conservation, two private landowners, the governor's staff, and the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And together, we were really, we came together to think about the common opportunities we have on working lands in Oregon and to develop a set of voluntary tools to meet the mutual goals of conservation and supporting our working lands base. So again, it's been almost a two-year effort that we've been coming together. This gives you a list of the actual individuals, and I should have another slide that has a table with 1,000 cups of coffee, because I think that's really what it took to create this program. It gives you a snapshot. Why did we focus on working lands? I mean, this committee knows better than any how important our working lands inventory are for the state. A quarter of our state is in agriculture production. It's our second most important economic driver for Oregon. And there was a recent study produced by the Portland State University and Oregon State that talks about the intergenerational transfer we're looking at here in Oregon. And it says that two-thirds of our agricultural lands are going to change hands in the next 20 years. And that's a matter of 10 million acres we're looking at. So there's a lot of complex issues at play. And it's determined that 80% of those landowners do not have a succession plan. And working lands also protect fish and wildlife habitat. And, you know, we do see that conversion and fragmentation is a real threat to those values we have in the state. And I wanted to provide just a visual for you. The map you're looking at is generated by the Oregon Conservation Strategy. And this is our state's overarching guide to how we meet our fish and wildlife habitat needs in the state. And it really couples the best of available science with a voluntary approach. And if you look at this, these are conservation opportunity areas where our fish and wildlife needs would be best met in the state. It's overlaid with a zoning map that shows you lands that are zoned for farming and ranching. And as you can see, there's a lot of complex complex overlays. But I just want to emphasize that the point of this program is to meet those fish and wildlife goals and also support working lands and keeping them in production.
Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't read the legend up on the top left-hand corner, so what are the colors representing?
Oh, yeah, sorry about that. So the yellow is agricultural EFU. The peach color is other agricultural types, and the brown is rangeland.
Thank you.
Yeah. So briefly, I'm just going to pivot now to walk you through the actual nuts and bolts of the program that the work group developed. Number one, it provides a grant program that supports landowners and conservation partners with a variety of tools. Succession planning, as I mentioned before, 80% of these families do not have a succession plan. Permanent conservation easements and termed covenants. Support for the development and implementation of conservation management plans, technical support for the organizations implementing these and helping and partnering with landowners. And the program also comes with a set of ranking criteria that ensure the highest and best projects rise to the top. And it also provides funding for a study, a tax-related study, to look at the potential barriers for succession planning. So how it works is that the program establishes an Oregon Agriculture Heritage Commission that includes four farmers and ranchers, four natural resource experts, one representative from Oregon State Extension, and one representative from LCDC, a tribal representative, and then an OWEB ex officio member. So I guess in conclusion, I just want to say we really believe this work group has worked hard, and we really believe that this program is critical right now for where we are in Oregon. We're facing a lot of long-term emerging threats, and this provides, it's not the panacea, but it provides a good effort at trying to put together a suite of voluntary tools we feel like are critical for Oregon. This bill, I just want to note, has really strong bipartisan support with 11 Democrat and 9 Republican co-sponsors representing folks from both the east side and west side of the state. So we really believe it can help leverage federal funding, support fish and wildlife, and really keep this partnership moving forward, because I think, as one of our work group members said best, we need each other, or agriculture and conservation. And so thank you very much for the opportunity to provide this overview.
Okay, Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why do only about 80% or less than, why do 80% not have succession plans?
It's a good question. I think that you'll hear from the landowners who will be before you today who can speak personally to the challenges that come up in keeping and just frankly having those conversations and keeping the family together. Oregon State currently has a Ties to the Land program for forest landowners, but there's really limited resources to help farm and ranching families from what we understand in those conversations.
I could comment on one factor. Sometimes the, I don't want to call him older farmer, but I'll just use a personal example. Sometimes my father-in-law didn't like the idea of spending money on lawyers, which is often what it involved, and he just hated it and hated lawyers generally. And lawyers. And the other issue is sometimes for fairness, it's easy just to say, okay, I'm going to leave it all 50-50. But often that is not the best idea, and it is highly advised by places like the Austin family planning to figure out who's going to operate it and hand it to them. And we're in a 50-50 battle right at the moment, so I wish somebody would have made it, because it's tough when they love their kids equally to do anything different, but in reality, not everybody's going to work on the farm, and you probably should not do that, it turns out, from my experience. Well, Vice Chair Springer.
That was what I was wondering about. I mean, if there's barriers in the system or policy changes that need to be made, that's one thing. If it's a tough conversation for a family to have, I don't know that we need government intervention in that piece.
Yeah. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was familiar with this project, or with the potential for this project up in Wallawa with the Wallawa Land Trust, but it's all funded by private dollars, you know, and my concern is for purchasing the conservation rights for property, I'm wondering what the cost would be, not the litigation that we're talking about here, but as far as purchasing the conservation rights and then asking the taxpayer to help pay for that. That was my big issue.
So you're wondering about the purchasing the development rights off of a property?
Well, the conservation rights, to preserving it, basically, that costs dollars. At least that's the way it's structured up in Willow County. And so the cost involved in this seems to be quite high.
Oh, thank you, Representative Barreto, Chair Clem. Just to address that, a property is sort of seen as coming with a bundle of a bundle of sticks with various rights, mineral rights, development rights, et cetera. And so when an individual decides to sell one of those, you know, they go through an evaluation, and usually there's a property, and again, I'm going to lean on the landowners we have here to maybe speak to that firsthand. But it is evaluated at the cost before when it could be subdivided, and then afterwards when it's not. And it's that differential that's purchased. And I think we can't argue about the public benefits that exist on our private lands inventory in terms of providing a local food base, protecting important soils, clean air, clean water, et cetera. So, I think that's why the USDA does have a federal program to, again, prevent fragmentation and purchase those development rights.
Yeah, and I understand that. And I'm, I think we're all into conservation. It's a matter of how much you can afford. And And so when I look at the conservation rights, what it costs to preserve those for each farm, for each ranch, for each piece of property, and I am certainly for these organizations up here that, that are backing this, and I certainly understand the succession issues today with the price of agricultural property going so high that it's very difficult to pay for that, you know, in the industry. And so getting to the problem, I understand that. It's paying for preserving the land that I'm concerned with.
I will give a real-world example. We had an appraisal done a few months ago of our orchard, and the appraiser said if you split it up into the four parcels that it currently is legally they're legally four separate parcels all with a house on them, but we aggregate them and farm them. If we split it up and sold them as four, it's $2.8 million. If we keep it as a farm, it's $2 million. And so there's this conversation right now in the family about who's going to do it, and if someone were going to continue to buy it out, what about the $800,000? And, you know, it's kind of an awkward conversation because half the family are realtors for a living, and they see the value in splitting it up, but, you know, the other half wants to keep it whole, and so it's kind of a dicey conversation that I'm not sure where it's going to lead. I think they'd like to keep farming it, but it, you know, it's my wife's side of the family, so I kind of shut up and don't say anything. But it's that's the real conversation. The other thing that we did recently, actually I've been here 10 years now, it wasn't that recently, 10 years ago we did pass an inheritance tax relief package for natural resource properties because there were a lot of growers who, again, don't like lawyers, so they didn't do inheritance tax planning, and they were sitting on tracts of land worth $30 or $40 million, but they had no cash in the actual bank. They were just sitting on all this farmland, farming it, not making much money on it. And so when they died, you would get this big fat tax bill. So we allow up to $15 million worth of ag natural resource lands to pass in Oregon tax-free to the kids, $7.5 million per parent. But that was designed to get at people who hadn't done their planning, because alternatively, you spend like $100,000 with lawyers in Portland, and they figure out how to pass it anyway. And it's the farmers who aren't wanting to spend that kind of money planning that end up benefiting from some of our actions here, so they don't have to go spend the money on lawyers. Okay, we've got a bunch of people. Any more for Kelly? Okay, let's get our next panel, which is Doug Kramer, Woody Wolf, and John O'Keefe up.
Members of the committee, I'm Doug Kramer. I'm a blueberry grower from St. Paul, Oregon. I was on this committee, and I was one of the private landowners that participated in this group. I do have a background of working with, I've been on the Oregon Ag Board. I've been on the OWEB board, and I'm a current member of the Oregon Farm Bureau. So, thank you. So, with those experiences in my past, I got selected to participate on this board, this working group. I found it challenging at times. When Kelly said that this group worked together and came to a conclusion, I can guarantee you it was not all a bed of roses getting there. We had good days. We had bad days. There was tough discussions. But I can tell you that we did find common ground between ag and conservationists, and I think it speaks to the committee that everybody expressed their desires for this legislation and also represented their interests to get to the point we are. It's too bad that not everybody that has interest in this could have been involved in that process. I know there's still some groups out there that oppose this particular proposal, but I think I can reassure you that if they had been involved in the process, that they probably would have come to the same conclusion, and I think they would probably support this bill also. I'm going to let the other landowners talk, but one of the things I'd really like to express here is that everything in this is voluntary. There's nothing that is... No landowner will be required to participate. If they wish to participate and they see a advantage to conservation and their operation, they will have that opportunity, but it's not a requirement. Thank you.
Chair Clam, Vice Chair McLean, Vice Chair Springer, members of the committee, my name is John O'Keefe. I'm the current president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Thank you for this opportunity to share my thoughts on House Bill 3249. To me, this is about passing farms and ranches on to the next generation. To others, this is about developing tools for landscape conservation. The tools in this bill are not for everyone, but they exist today in one form or another. So, among other things, we wish to level the playing field for Oregon producers. Here I'm referring to the non-federal match required by some NRCS programs. Currently, this is a problem in Oregon. Also, keep in mind these tools are voluntary. Conservation easements are the most controversial aspect of this bill. These have been discussed long and hard at the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. This was quite some time ago when we worked to establish the Oregon Rangeland Trust, now known as the Northwest Rangeland Trust. After much discussion, we decided that easements were there, our members used them, and they would continue to be used. With this in mind, we felt that we wanted to be sure that there were opportunities for easements that were friendly to agriculture, held by those that understood agriculture and shared our values regarding easements on productive working lands. This has not changed. Something new in this bill, conservation covenants. Basically a conservation easement with a fixed term. I'm told for technical reasons these shouldn't be called easements, thus the term covenant. These may not be as popular with conservation funders because they are looking for permanency, but they will be much more popular with landowners who are hesitant, and rightfully so, to engage in permanent easements. As we do this, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are finishing the greater sage-grouse mitigation strategy. Oregon went to great lengths so that we would have options to pursue projects that would benefit our rural communities and sage-grouse regions. We don't know what the final product will look like yet, but mitigation has to last as long as the project being mitigated. There needs to be a legal means to provide durability. Conservation covenants may perform this role very nicely. Also, it may be very hard to find acres to sign up for mitigation projects if the only vehicle available to provide project durability is a permanent easement. So again, conservation covenants may well be a solution to enable a viable mitigation strategy. Oregon will someday address its tax issues. I certainly hope when this happens, estate taxes go away. They are very problematic for high asset, low liquidity entities that make up agriculture. The included study is a needed first step. Thank you for this opportunity. Please support House Bill 3249.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, Vice Chair Springer, members of the committee. My name is Woody Wolf. I'm a farmer in Northeast Oregon in Wallowa County. I'm a sixth generation farmer, and my knowledge, I put the first agricultural easement on a working land in the state of Oregon. I have had that in place since 2011, and I am and have been a forage producer and a small grain producer, and I'm switching my practice to no-till, nutrient cycling, intensive grazing, and getting away from the small grains. And living in a scenic area such as Wallowa County, prices of land are often derived from you know, the highest and best use, as you, Chair Clem, were alluding to, that $800,000 or roughly a 25 to 30% increase in your land value was to splitting it up. And so that would make it difficult for your heirs to purchase that in at full market value at the 2.8 and then continue to run it as an orchard. Mm-hmm. The similar things exist in Wallowa County. Property values are probably double what ag production values are, or very close to. I'm very pleased with the easement that I've put on part of the ranch that I own, and so far I've had a great working relationship with the entity. I'm in the process of securing another easement on more acres. This one using the NRCS match. 50% contribution, and then I'm contributing 25%, which is maximum stipulation that the Natural Resource Conservation Service allows. And so there is a 25% that has to come from somewhere. And so through these two conservation easements on working lands, the second one should close this June, and it's going to have taken 13 years to find the funding available to conserve 200 and, well, it'll be almost 455 acres. And to address Representative Barreto's question earlier about spending public money for private interests, and then Ms. Beamer alluded to that the public has an interest in the clean water, and Representative Barreto's concern was the cost of it, and I would actually argue that it's a great value being able to purchase an easement in perpetuity for 25% of the appraised value and protect the land and the management practices relative to conservation, which correlates to watershed health and environmental quality, which benefits the public. And through this bill and this process, there will be a limited amount of funding, and these lands will be awarded on a merit-based system. So you're concentrating your efforts on the most valuable property as determined by the people on the committee to approve these possibilities. And so I would ask what the cost is if these lands did become concrete or developed, and their environmental quality that exists now became degraded. It's sort of the ounce of prevention for a pound of cure, and you have to believe that the cure is going to be necessary someday to buy into that. But I would argue that it's a great value and a great use for public money. And I appreciate your time. Please support this House bill.
And one question I've got. These properties still stay on the tax rolls, right?
Yes.
So that's the other way for me to think about it versus the whole pavement, analogy or, what could happen. The other option I've seen is I'll see, like, ODF&W use money to, like, buy a whole ranch and take it off the tax rolls and maybe not even have it leased back for ranching either. It's conservation. And so this is kind of that middle ground where keep it on the tax rolls, keep it farming rather than just buy and hold. And your money will go further because you're not paying the full price to buy a whole place. You're just maybe able to do four or five levels of conservation instead of just one in that case.
And it also opens the door for more conservation through other grant programs that you may become more desirable to receive because they know that property is protected. And if they spend that money on private property, then it's not going to switch hands and be degraded within a few years, just relative to the easement being attached to the title.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Representative Escobar.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, do you get one lump sum of money out of this, or do you get yearly money? And if so, don't mind me asking, how much are we talking about?
There are different ways to structure it. I chose to reduce debt so my business would cash flow, and I gave up the increase in the value part of the land that I sold forever for a lump sum now. And so the easement that I'm working on currently that's about to close, to give an example, there's 267 acres that I believe appraised at about $4,700 an acre gross, and the easement was about $1,500 an acre. So the lump sum that it's going to, it would take to protect 267 acres of riverfront riparian area surrounded by farm ground is $375,000, and then I am donating a percentage of that back, and so I will receive $328,000.
Follow-up. So what was the initial amount of money you received? I'm curious of what this is costing.
On the first easement, I received $200,000 to protect, put an easement on 197 acres.
Thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just thinking that this panel could give us some real-life examples of projects that this bill might help us accomplish. Maybe some contributions to the Oregon plan for salmon and watersheds, maybe the restoration of some native grasses, maybe erosion control. Can you describe for us the potential that this bill holds?
One of the things that I briefly alluded to in my testimony is as we get into sage grouse mitigation, I think that there might be some opportunities to create a situation because they're the actual on-the-ground work is only part of mitigation. That you need the framework to provide the durability so that when the licensing agency for the power line or whatever's going on does the mitigation, they know that whatever ground's mitigated will be there for the life of the project. So that's one of the places that I look to see a chance for this to come into play.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I farm here in the valley and up in Klatskanai, I think you're aware.
Yes,
and so I don't know if I would end up using it on my ground, but obviously the potential is along the rivers and streams that we're trying to protect with vegetation for clean water purposes. And so that's where I see this coming in, and I think it's really important that you understand that this particular proposal is part of a piece of a puzzle. As you heard, there's a national program. This would be public monies for a state program, but this also sets up a framework that additional private monies from foundations and donations can be put in that can also be used. And I would see this program using at least as much, if not more, private dollars through this program as it's going to use public dollars.
Okay. A specific example to answer your question is the piece of property that part of it has an easement on it now, and the rest of it is about to, is a large collection area for return irrigation flows and natural runoff to the landscape. And so one of the proposed projects after the easement is attached is to manipulate the water flow and restore the wetland so that the water, as it comes in fast, is held up and it forced down through the ground and it comes back into the river cooler and cleaner throughout the year. And it's these types of projects with an easement on it that then other funding opens up through the conservation entities, because they're willing to put money into something that is, they have a reason to believe will be protected.
Thank you. And Mr. O'Keefe, I can't miss the opportunity while you're right here, sir, for a crappie report. I understand ancient lakes in your area are filling, the likes of which haven't occurred in a generation's time.
You know, it's been a while, and absolutely, we're already seeing vehicles parked along the lakes. I'm not sure how the fish can get there that quick, but next year, sir.
Amen.
We'll walk for you. Stop by when you're in town.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Barretta.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Woody. First of all, thank you for your testimony. You had mentioned 25% of appraised value, and that was for a permanent easement. And then in the bill, we're talking about a working land conservation covenant that is temporary or a fixed, it's got a fixed term on it. So if it's 25% of appraised value on a permanent easement, what are we looking at percentage wise for a fixed?
See, I've not done the term covenants, so it would be less. I mean, where that would be put, I'm not sure. 25% buys perpetuity, assuming that the landowner is willing to donate 25% and they qualify for the NRCS 50%. It would be my intuition that it would be much less if it's a term, because then some of the work or the management that had been done during that time could possibly be degraded later. So it should be significantly less.
The term would be flexible, I would assume, and as far as the amount or the percentage would probably be also negotiable. I mean, is that kind of what the thought is behind it?
I would certainly think that that'd be the way it'd work. We are hopeful that this will be a mechanism that will provide some kind of a thing more acceptable to the agricultural community than the permanent easements. There's a lot of concern about the permanent easements, and a lot of people are real hesitant to go there. There might be things that we can do here. I mean, I would really want to say that I'm a huge fan of working lands as working lands. I think they provide a great service standalone without easements, without these other things. But urban boundaries, urban encroachment, high scenic values, there are times when working lands alone won't get you to the next generation or whatever situation comes up, and that's where I see this bill coming in, not as a trying to cover the whole landscape, but having it in place so that when these situations come up, we've got tools to use. And I think a covenant's a creative new tool, and the smart guys that appraise this stuff, I think it's basically a mathematical exercise to convert a perpetual payment into a term payment, and I don't have a numerical example.
Thank you.
Representative McKeown.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I just so appreciate the three of you coming here to present today. This is fascinating, interesting work. And if I missed something, hopefully you can clarify it for me. And if it hasn't been discussed, I'd like to know a little bit more about it. But, you know, negotiating the financial side of it is one thing, but I'm hearing words of conservation, easements, negotiations. Where does access fit in here? If there's a conservation easement on a piece of property that you know, of course, have great interest in and are working around and in, does this open you up to public access in some regard? Could somebody address that for me, please?
Yes. Currently on my easements, I still control ingress and egress.
Okay.
And so that's just a value derivation. So based on... So you can include or exclude access or fishing and hunting rights or things of this nature, and then that will be addressed in the appraisal and show up, you know, the rights that you're giving up are negotiable. And so as they accumulate or minimize, then your value goes up and down.
Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that.
Okay, now to hear the other side of the story. Thank you, gentlemen. Let me call up some folks that have signed up against. That's Garrett Rosenthal, Jim Myron, and David Moskowitz. Got you signed up first here.
Okay. I was going to let Mr. Moskowitz go first, but he submitted testimony earlier. But I will go ahead. I'm representing Chair Clem and Vice Chairs McLean and Springer and members of the committee. My name is Garrett Rosenthal. I live in rural Tualatin, and I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon. And we feel we've submitted testimony and supplemental materials. We feel the need to recommend against HB 3249 and a companion piece, 3247. It appears to be a well-intentioned effort to provide more stimulus for environmentally sensitive management of agricultural and ranch lands. And as an environmental activist and someone who has worked on environmental management for over 40 years and as a long-term member of at least two of the groups on the working task, this creates a little cognitive dissonance for me, but nonetheless, I have to proceed. It provides for grants to create and programs related to succession planning, implementation, conservation management plans, and technical assistance to organizations that are or might be involved in conservation management. These are worthy goals. However, on closer investigation, HB 3249 has significant flaws both technically and physically. On the technical side, I would refer primarily to the testimony that you'll hear from Mr. Moskowitz on behalf of a consortium including the Deschutes River Keepers and Tax and the Willamette River Keepers and so forth. On the basis for Tax Fairness Oregon's expertise, we want to emphasize a certain lack of physical responsibility in the proposed measure, and we feel that four issues are key. One is the tax subsidies to farmers and ranchers overall. Second is succession planning in particular. A third is additional funding for nonprofits in an arena of conservation management. And four is general budgetary availability of resources. Existing tax subsidies, as our supplemental material supplies. Currently, in the biennium, we are providing subsidies that total over $550 million to this sector of the economy in the next biennium. The current session is considering 18 bills aimed at this one sector alone. We feel the time in this time of budget shortfall is not one to create new or expand existing programs that potentially could cost a significant amount of money. As our supplemental information shows, the state shows fiscal losses in this market sector. Given the revenue shortfall, we feel that new programs and commissions need to be balanced either by an independent funding source from the industry or by trimming or eliminating one or more of the existing subsidies. We think that's just a good fiscal prudence. Regarding succession planning, we would note that an emphasis is misplaced for several reasons. First, the online review indicates that there is substantial and considerable body of information available to provide for that assistance. Oregon State University has a celebrated ties to the land program, and farm bureaus nationwide are geared to helping farmers. As the chair has mentioned, the Austin Family Business Program, there's also Family Business 360, the National Center for Employee Ownership, and Oregon Small Business Development Center Network are some of the references available. There are many personal issues involved in this process, and perhaps the state is not the best in position to deal with this. Secondly, succession planning for individual farming operations should be primarily the responsibility of the farm business owner and should not require significant use of public funds. We feel the state's role should be to assist Oregon businesses generally by providing information and tools, but not target one specific sector. Funding for nonprofits, we recognize the vital role that many nonprofits play in sectors of civic life, including assistance to the agriculture community and sustainability and resource management. But we feel that this current proposal is so unstructured as to provide merely a basis for building nonprofit organizations without specific metrics for public benefit. The bill would provide development funding or technical assistance to organizations that enter into the purpose enter into agreements resulting in conservation management plans. This provides no guarantee of environmental or public benefit, focuses only on plans and not on concrete actions, and allows grants for development without guidelines or result-based evaluations. Finally, our budget concerns overall. As the supplemental material indicates, we have a large number of programs to assist our important agricultural industries, but we do not have a process in place to compare these programs for their cost benefit. We have a looming $1.6 billion shortfall, of which I know you're all aware, and an additional $1 billion in unfunded educational needs statewide. We simply cannot afford to create new programs, especially poorly defined programs, without specific targeted results or specifically defined public benefits. It may be well-intentioned, but we really just cannot afford it. Our opinion is that now is not the time. These ideas need further development. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, yeah, let's do all three first and then come back.
Thank you, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Myron. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. The Deschutes River Alliance, Willamette River Keepers, and Northwest Environmental Advocates. I want to call your attention to some information that was submitted to the committee a couple of weeks ago. We did a section-by-section analysis of the bill, and that is online, and I would recommend your indulgence in looking at that. We've got some real concerns with a number of provisions in this bill. Not the least of which is it's pretty comprehensive and a bit confusing at times. And we met last week with some of the proponents of the bill from the land conservation community, and we understand their concern about the fragmentation issue, but the bill goes far beyond just the issue of fragmentation. It includes the development of a new OWEB-like system of a board and a fund. And the board represents primarily agricultural interests, but it's public dollars going into the fund. There's just a number of issues. And while there may be some positive things in this bill, It doesn't seem like it's ready for prime time yet. This SMS for the bill is pretty good at lining out what issues are in the bill, but there's no fiscal impact statement. When this thing was first brought forward, it was a component of OWEB's agency request budget, and as I recall, they were asking for about $2 million to get the program up and running and have some money in the grant fund. The governor, in her wisdom, did not include it in her budget because of fiscal issues, primarily, I would assume. I haven't spoken to her about it. But let me just highlight some of the main issues that we have that have yet to be resolved. First of all is the cost, and why the public should pick up that cost, especially during these sorts of critical budget times where there's not a lot of extra general fund laying around. There is no extra general fund laying around. Secondly, the whole bill itself is pretty incoherent and doesn't seem to have any a coherent purpose. There's no assurances that the tax dollars this bill proposes to spend on the private estate planning will produce any kind of a public benefit, as my gentleman next to me mentioned. Estate planning costs should be the responsibility of every individual who has an estate. I mean, I don't expect anybody to pick up my estate planning costs. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And finally, I know we're running out of time here, but to us, there's still an issue of the agricultural impacts, the impacts of agricultural practices on waters and lands of the state. Right now, we don't believe that the existing program at the Department of Agriculture to control ag water quality is sufficient. I spent 15 years on the Molalla Pudding Ag Water Quality Management Plan Advisory Committee. After spending a couple of years working with the Department of Ag developing the rules for this program. And it was brought forward by the agricultural community simply to avoid an Agricultural Practices Act. They didn't want a Forest Practices Act-like program for ag. The current program is based on outcomes. The Forest Management Practice Act is based on regulating activities. I think we need something similar for ag because the ag program is not working. It's been in place for 20 years, and they have very little to show for that huge expenditure of money. So I'm kind of bouncing around here, but these are some of the issues that the organizations that I am representing are struggling with. And we weren't invited to the table to sit down and help develop this thing. It's developed by people that either have a direct financial interest in the outcome or receive some sort of a benefit from the proposal. So anyway, I'll close at that and be happy to answer questions.
Great, Dave.
My name is David Moskowitz with the Conservation Angler. Chair Clem, Co-Chair McLean, and Co-Chair Sprenger, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill. There's some admirable efforts by this work group and that resulted in this bill, but it brings together two very disparate things, both of which are important to the state, of course, and conservation being one. And then the idea of succession planning for land and estates. That's an issue. It's like retirement. Every one of us probably needs to do a better job at saving for retirement and planning for our future. There's some admirable things in here about that. And Section 11, really, if any part of this bill should go forward, Section 11 is probably it, because it talks about doing that research to look at the tax and financial barriers to land succession within families. That's an important issue. However, it's merged in a vague way with conservation gains at protecting natural resource values, which are not clearly defined in the bill. This bill is also very expensive. There's multiple technical committees to reimburse, and a whole new board to fund, a whole new state board, this Heritage Board. There's state agencies that have very important programs for fish and wildlife and for landowners that are on the cutting room floor right now with the Department of Fish and Wildlife budget, their stream restoration program, their water resources program. DEQ's budget is not adequately funded, nor is the Water Resources Department. And with the limited dollars that are out there, we feel that this, the expense of this bill is coming at the wrong time. The new board that will be created, we believe, is heavily weighted towards producers and landowners. There's a reference for someone being appointed by the Department of Agriculture or the Board of Agriculture who's an expert in ag water quality. I don't even know what that is. It's not defined, and it's clearly an issue in the state that water quality is not always protected by ag. So that particular seat seems a little bit odd. I think that we heard some very interesting examples about prior tax relief that, Chair, you mentioned about the $15 million limit. And these are clearly important issues for Oregon. But we have to, what's being ignored here are really the international and national pressures on land and land development. And for being, if we're going to let, we always talk about wanting to have the market be able to have a free hand, this is putting definitely more than one finger on the scale in terms of trying to address what are international and national pressures on what parts of agriculture are valuable and what's going to happen in this land in the future. Section 11, we would say that has a high state interest, and there should be funding for a committee to look at this and come back with real issues that deal with the tax barriers, the financial barriers to keeping land in contiguous ownerships, because we do believe there is value to that. But that needs to be studied, and we need to have more comprehensive solutions to the barriers for all these people on that committee that want to do good things. We support that, and we think that the table should be a little bigger. As Mr. Kramer said, we might be sitting here in support if we had been at the table. And I thank you very much for the opportunity. Happy to answer any questions.
Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know so much that I have a question, but I heard a few things in the testimony. One of the things I heard was the state is there to support these activities and not fund them. I can't allow this moment to pass without acknowledging the work of the folks that were at the table. You have Cattlemen's Association and Thousand Friends of Oregon, and in my world, that's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing where I come from, and they did a lot of hard work to get to a place of agreement. But I've got to believe that part of the reason they needed to be at the table was the way the government, the state of Oregon, makes it difficult. And so if we're going to talk about government supporting, then before we have that conversation, we need to talk about water resources, DEQ, some of these other agencies that make it more difficult to make a living on those lands. So let's not forget that part, and those are the people that also pay taxes and grow the general fund.
I will just make one comment for your benefit, I think, because this is a real life example that I described earlier in our orchard's value. But the land use system generally lowers the value of the land on purpose so farmers can farm. And if we didn't have a land use system and we just used the free market, our 80 acres, all looking right at Mount Hood, is probably worth about $40 million. It would look a lot like Vail, Colorado, you know, or Aspen. It would be a ski village with a lot of condos. But a lot of us really strongly believe in farming and are willing to forego all that system. And in fact, I came here to fight Measure 37, which cost our family God knows how much money because we didn't want to turn it into subdivisions. Everybody around us had filed a claim just to protect their rights, but I helped write something that cost our family tens of millions of dollars in foregone value because we believe in farming. If we have a vote on the $2.8 million to split it up and sell four parcels to Californians to have views, or $2 million to keep it together, I'd vote to keep the $2 million. I don't care about the $800,000 in value. And I think most of our family feels that way. So you're dealing with voluntary landowners who have options, even with the restrictions of the land use system, to sell their land for view lots. And this tool is to try and say, maybe we could coax them into permanently making a decision to do it rather than against their own financial self-interest selling it. So I know you have points, but the comparisons that you have to make is, yes, you are trying to use OWEB money or Measure 76 money to incent people to do something, but the alternative literally is paving some lands over. Some that aren't marginal, that aren't, don't have good views, I would not argue that those need the high level of incentive to keep them in they're not at risk for being converted. But the appraisals required usually factor that in. If they're really nice parcels that have views, the appraisal will elevate them. If they're junk out in the middle of nowhere that has no view, it's not going to appraise so high. So I think that's self-rectifying. But I don't want to discourage you from you know, airing your concerns. But the reality is people have choices. And one choice that's really easy to take is sell out. And Orange County, California is a prime example of tons of generations of people deciding to sell out for housing. And I'm positive there are less ecosystem services in Orange County than there are in any agricultural districts in the state of Oregon. And you're welcome to respond.
Chair Clem, just thank you. I think that there are countless examples, as you've just spoke to, and there have been several other people that have as well. We believe there are existing mechanisms to address some of these key problems. I mean, this land conservation through easements, through purchases with conservation groups such as the ones that are on the working group, they exist. They're under negotiation, you know, every day. This new program needs more a tighter association. If you're protecting natural resource values, it should be more tightly brought in to OWEB. Why do we create a separate board, a new board, to do this? We believe the existing mechanisms throughout this whole, you could call it an industry, land conservation industry, between the ag and producer community and the land conservation community, there's a lot of existing tools to address a lot of those key issues that you've mentioned and other people have spoke to. This bill, I think it muddles the water.
Okay, we've got three more. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Three more to come on up. Joe Dawson, who came all the way from Alawa County. I should have got you up here first. I'm so sorry. And then Muriel. And there's one more in there, Tom Wolf. Joe, usually we get the 100-mile or more people, which I know you're a lot more than 100 miles, up first. I'm sorry I didn't catch that sooner, so please.
Oh, no worries. Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, and Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak. My name is Joe Dawson. I'm from Joseph, Oregon, and I'm a third-generation farmer from both sides of my family, so I can attest to the headaches that are caused by successional planning and living in a scenic area as well. Three things I was asked to point out is, one, the bill does not specifically appropriate any funds that decision made in ways means it would be if it were the committee moves the bill forward. I'm sorry if I read that incorrectly. I'm taking notes from behind me. And two, succession planning support is accomplished by adding farm concerns and issues to existing program and run by OSU Extension. And it's efficient in ways to deliver service in a general way to a broader group in great of need of information. And I can attest to that because, you know, as third generation, the problem with, you know, generational farms is the more cousins you have that never got their hands dirty on the farm have no connection had it at all. So when they look at land values and they say, oh, well, you know, I want that fair market value because that's what the realtors in your area are going for, it's just not feasible for anyone in our area. And I'm not the only one in our area that's dealing with one of these challenges. But another thing that I can say on a personal level on the conservation land easements and why this program excites me is it encourages you to get together and talk about your conservation plans moving forward with this program. And one of the biggest things that we've been working on and implementing is water conservation. And also on our fish-bearing streams, it's fish and wildlife enhancement. So that's what these funds are going for, is not only to keep the ag lands in ag so they doesn't get subdivided up into just another little Aspen town, but to make sure that they're continuing to be functional moving forward. And my fear is if we don't have a program like this in place, you know, I'm one of many farmers in our area that's doing successional planning, that a lot of them are going to say it's easier to cash out. It's easier to take the $5,000-$6,000 an acre, if not more, if you're allowed to subdivide it up, than it is to work your hands off every year to year. And that would just kill me, because that's just part of the charm of the area, is the amazing wildlife and the amazing farm grounds that are there, and the waterways and the streamways. I mean, it's all connected. And also, lastly, to add to it, is the fund is designed to accept private dollars. So to say that this is purely public is not accurate. So, but thank you for letting me speak today.
Thanks for coming so far as well. Okay, Tom or Muriel, whoever wants to.
Chair Clem, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf with the Trout Unlimited, the nation's largest cold water conservation group. I'm just going to be real brief. Trout Unlimited supports this bill, HB 3249. In fact, we even saw our logo up there. So we had a long discussion about this, but we have within the state 15 paid staff and 3,200 members, and we had the board, and we decided that even though we pride ourselves on being an advocacy group that works on a lot of issues and testifies a lot, and I just testified for the 1,000th time last week, so obviously that's important to us. But what's important to us all is to reach across and work with farms, work with private landowners on ways to protect streams in there and encourage them, and HB 3249 does that. It you got a lot of people that normally don't always get together, and they got together for 2 years to talk and work out a solution. So it's not a perfect bill, and there's things that probably need to be fixed in it, but it's a great effort. And lastly, I want to end with 17 years ago, I was on the Healthy Stream Partnership, which was the advisory group for the Oregon Salmon Plan. I sat on there with a rancher from Southeast Oregon named Fred Otley, and we were out after a meeting once, having a long talk, and he worried about what was going to happen to his ranch after he passed, because his sons weren't interested in taking it over, and he was worried that it was going to be sold and developed. So what's in this bill deals with a successional planning, and I've sat on a lot of committees over the year with farmers, and that's always an issue I heard, is what happens to my land? How do we keep it from being parceled out? How do we protect the farmland? And so this bill deals with this, and as a sixth-generation Oregonian, who was also born in Wallowa County, although we left a long time ago, I love this land. I love this state. I love farms. And even though many times I'm testifying against some of the farm groups, this one, I adamantly support this bill. We believe it's the best solution. Trout Unlimited supports this. We urge that there are some problems that maybe they can be dealt with, but we urge that this bill goes forward because we think this is the best solution for fish, wildlife, farms, and Oregon in general. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Hi, members of the committee. Chair, Mariel Darzin with 1000 Friends of Oregon. I'm not normally the one who does the testimony. I'm a staff attorney over in Central Oregon, but happy to be here today and testifying in support of this bill. I generally work on the land use side of things, LUBA, a lot of the stuff you were talking about earlier today, but I also have a strong knowledge base on conservation side. I used to work for a land trust in Washington State, and when I moved to Oregon 5 years ago, I was really surprised to learn that Oregon doesn't have an agricultural conservation program through its state. Washington does, and I just wanted to give a short example of something that was accomplished there that I thought was really impressive was the land trust I worked for, we were able to conserve a 700-acre dairy along the Black River in Thurston County, and it was a working dairy, not a huge dairy. I mean, we have that's small for a dairy. It was along a river. It had Oregon spotted frog habitat. And in order to permanently conserve that dairy, which was a third-generation farmer, we needed funding from... I wrote down all the partners. So the Nature Conservancy, the Land Trust, the county, two Indian tribes, the state, two different state agencies, and federal funding. So I think some of the proponents of this bill have talked about all the puzzle pieces to being able to permanently conserve farmland, and we really did need all the pieces, and I think the state plays a really important role in that. It doesn't have to play the primary role. There is a lot of federal funding available, but this bill really fills in an important gap and will allow some of those critical heritage farms that also contain important habitat to be permanently conserved. And it's something that I think Oregon needs to sort of add to its array of protection mechanisms. The land use system is really strong, but having a conservation program like this is a really important piece of the puzzle as well. So 1000 Friends strongly supports it and encourages a yes vote on this bill. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for your testimony. Thanks for coming down. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3249. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3041. Ask Representative McLean to join us and Jenny Dressler. Okay, it looks fairly straightforward, but tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This bill would increase the tax credit given to those who, from 15% to 25% of the value of crops donated to the Oregon Food Bank and assorted like nonprofits, resulting in more incentive to donate. In 2014, Senate Bill 1541, by the way, my name is Mike McLean. I'm the state representative for District 55, which is central and southern Oregon. In 2014, Senate Bill 1541 reinstated the Oregon Crop Donation Tax Credit. It passed the House and the Senate unanimously. However, the latest numbers from the Oregon Food Bank show that 16.1% of Oregonians are still food insecure. In 2014, Crook County, my home county, had one of the highest food insecurity rates in Oregon at over 20%. 270,000 disadvantaged Oregonians rely on emergency food sources like the Oregon Food Bank on a monthly basis. In 2014, it was estimated that approximately 11 pounds of food are donated for every $1 in tax credit extended, resulting in 3.2 million meals for Oregonians in need. House Bill 3041 again raises it from 15 to 25%, creating more incentive. Local food producers account for over half of the donations to Oregon Food Bank. This extra incentive will offset the cost of growing and packaging the donated produce. I know that there is, I didn't check, but I know there must be a subsequent referral to revenue where the chairman will certainly have something to say about increasing the tax credit. But at least for this committee, I ask you to move the bill to revenue. And again, appreciate the chairman for his personal support, Representative Witt and others, Representative Springer, who have always advocated with me for this tax credit. Thank you.
Okay. The faster you go, the more likely your colleague from Farm Bureau gets to talk about solar.
Perfect. Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are here today to throw our support behind House Bill 3041 and echo the representative's comments. Farmers and ranchers currently can qualify to receive a tax credit of 15% of the wholesale value of the food crops that they donate. Even before this credit, many farmers donated food crops because it was the right thing to do. But there are some pretty significant cost barriers to getting those crops to the food bank and to other charitable organizations. Increasing that credit to 25% would allow even more farmers and ranchers to participate and would likely increase the amount of food that is being donated to hungry Oregonians. We see this as a cost-effective investment to help Oregon farmers provide healthy food to those in need. We understand the budget situation this session, but should resources come available, we would ask for your strong support of House Bill 3041. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for these two? Fairly straightforward. Okay. Thank you, Jody. You're up on the other side of the issue here.
Jody Weiser speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. So this tax credit actually went away from 2011 until 2014, came back in 2014 as a subsidy not just for things that are left in the field to be cleaned, but also for products that are delivered to the food bank or another food distribution center. So it's only been in place. We only have records for 1 year's worth of donations at the 15% level. So it's hard to say, why do we know we should be changing it to 25%? Or, you know, why do we are we doing it? We don't have any statistical analysis to go on, really, to say that there's a the need is there, and there's no way to pay for it except to take the money out of some program that we're already facing cuts for. Also, we note that there are lots of other businesses that donate food. Bakeries donate food. Grocery stores donate food. Restaurants donate food. They don't get any tax credit at all, and they incur the same costs for their crop. Only it's in a can now or in a bag, you know, a bread bag. They've incurred all the same costs, and yet they're not getting a tax credit. So it's hard to really explain why the farmers should be treated so differently for their product than other food donators are treated for theirs. They all get to deduct as a business expense the cost of the goods that they're donating, because that's just part of the basic business, whether they sell the product or not. If you're growing a crop or you're buying a loaf of bread that goes stale or tomatoes that are getting older, you have the cost. And if you're a grocery store and you donate it, we're not providing some special benefit to incent it, and yet they are making those donations. So why do we treat farmers so differently? If you look at the other material that Garrett provided about all the subsidies for farms, it's like, okay, if we're going to do this, then what are we not going to do? Because the subsidies are enormous for this one industry.
Okay, questions? Great, thank you. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3041, and we'll get the paperwork and back on that one. Then I want to do the two work sessions while I've, you know, we lost Rhett McCune. I was going to say, well, I had everybody. First of all, is there any objection to suspending the rules in order to allow Representative Springer to vote on the farm-to-school bill? Okay, seeing none. How do you vote on farm-to-school going to Ways and Means?
Yes.
Okay. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2566. This is the mentoring program Representative Witt talked to us about earlier in session. We had it last week and didn't have the paperwork. We now have the paperwork.
Chair Klein, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated 3/24/17.
Vice Chair Springer moves the -2 amendments dated 3/24/17. What are the Dash 2 amendments?
Chair Klem, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments replace the original measure that talked about an adult hunter mentoring program and instead focuses on the youth hunter mentoring program, increasing the age limit for youth participating from 14 years of age to 16 years of age.
Great. Any discussion on these Dash 2s? Representative Witt, do you like these Dash 2s?
They are wonderful Dash 2. Okay. In fact, I have never seen a better set of Dash 2 amendments. And
okay. Any objection to these Dash 2s?
Wow.
Okay. Seeing none.
Chair Klem, I move House Bill 2566 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2566 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, to the floor. Representative White, would you like to carry that?
Thank you, Mr.
All
Chair.
All right. Okay, parks. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2318. Colleagues, you may remember this is the bill that allows parks to adjust the rates so they're not always the same at every single park. Their thought was some places could have more, a lot of places could have less, and this helps kind of balance out the load, hopefully. Representative Escobar.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, when I don't know how it's entered, but when we have a member missing and we do, no one objects to it.
They end up showing as excused.
Okay, good. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get a motion. We can talk about it.
Chair Klem, I move House Bill 2318 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Springer moves House Bill 2318 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion. Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to give kudos to the Parks Department because I've had reservations about this bill from the beginning, and we've had a lot of conversations about this. I'm going to support the bill. A couple little caveats. One is I'd like to have a report back to this committee in post-summer season, because that's what this is going to be about. I'd like a report back to see how this is working. And part of the motivation to this bill has been to increase visitorship at lesser used parks. I've got one of those that you put up there as the poster child. And so I want to hear about that and see if indeed we're getting to where we think we're going to get with this bill.
Okay. Any further discussion on this one? Okay. Any objection to this bill? Okay. We'll send it to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. We'll do a carrier later, or they'll do a carry if it comes out of there. Okay. So we've got 5 minutes, and we have too many people, but I would like to get at least an explanation of this next bill, House Bill 3050. So let me open a public hearing and ask Mary Ann to come and spend, 5 minutes telling us about it. Those, the rest of you are here. I apologize. I should have figured out the time issue earlier. And we will carry it over, and we will start with this on Thursday. Please. And Mariel, did you want to join? 5 minutes total.
Perfect. I will be very brief. Chair Klem, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ann Nash, here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We have been working on this concept as a result of concerns that we've heard from our members around mass mailings that they're getting from solar companies looking to site solar facilities on high-value farmland, particularly in the Willamette Valley. And right now, the current rules do allow for siting of solar on high-value farmland with no alternatives analysis. What we are looking to do with this bill is to add in an alternatives analysis that would require solar companies to look for alternative sites and use alternative sites if they are available prior to siting solar facilities on high-value farmland. We think this is appropriate because, as this committee has heard numerous times, that Willamette Valley has some of the most productive farmland in the world, and we think that it is of vital importance that it is protected, and any time that you get a particular interest from a non-farm use, that can cause
prices to raise, and it can just cause shifts in the market that will start to incentivize folks to, for example, put in solar instead of remaining in farming, which can start to change the overall character of the area and cause, you know, cause other impacts to the overall fabric of the agricultural community. And so, again, we think it is appropriate that solar companies should have to look to non-high-value lands prior to being able to site on high-value farmlands when they're looking at solar projects.
Yeah, I would echo all of that. Mariel Darzin, 1000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you. Solar development, well, we're as at 1000 Friends, we support renewable energy, but we feel strongly that solar development should be directed at or near the point of use within the built environment on existing industrial sites or otherwise unusable space, not the highest value farmland. This bill doesn't change the acreage limitations that are currently in place for high-value farmland. All it does is provide something that's actually, it's already in place for wind development. So when you site a wind farm, you have to go through an alternatives analysis to show that you've looked at other viable sites and you've had to pick this one because none of the other ones work for a variety of reasons. All this does, this bill, is it adds that step of analysis for solar siting on high-value farmland, not even on non-high-value farmland, just high-value farmland. You have to show that you cannot put it anywhere else except for this one site. So it's really a step that we think should be in place for if you're going to put a non-farm use that takes high-value farmland out of production for a long period of time, that there should be this necessary study before you're allowed to put it there.
Okay, so what I'm going to do, because I think there's a couple of people here who aren't the usual suspects who are always here on the other side, so I'm going to close this public hearing, need to go back for a second and have Representative McEwen vote. Then I'm going to ask Marty Dozler and Damian Hall to come up from the other side, just so you don't have to come back again, and then we will have the other people go on Thursday. But I do want to real quickly close the public hearing on House Bill 3050. I don't know that I need to open work sessions, but I do need to ask, does anybody have an objection to suspending the rules to have Representative McEwen vote on our work sessions on 2566, which is the youth mentoring, and the 2318 adjustable rate for parks? Any objections? Seeing none, Representative McEwen, House Bill 2566 on the hunting mentoring. Aye. And Representative McEwen, House Bill 2318 on the adjustable fees for parks.
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks. Let me reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3050. And let me say this, colleagues, several of the members will have to leave right now because they all have appointments. I'll stay for a few minutes to make sure we get your testimony in, but it's not that they don't like you. It's they all were promised we'd be done by 10, and we're not quite, and I don't want you to have to come back because I know you came down just for this. So, please.
Okay.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair, member of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Marty Dozler. I am a fourth generation farmer in the Almsville area. My family owns and operates Mark Lewis Farm, which fully supports seven families that work full-time on the farm. All of us third, fourth, and fifth generation farmers. We are here today to provide testimony in opposition of House Bill 3050. As farmers, we believe that every farmer should have the ability and the opportunity to place solar facilities on our property if they choose, regardless where they live in the state. The current rules are thoughtfully created, and they strike a balance of promoting the renewable goals of the state while protecting the best agricultural ground. Even when solar facilities are placed on so-called high-value farm ground, the land may not be considered high-valued by the farmer. The site could be rocky, produce lower yields, and may be difficult to farm due to many number of reasons. This is the case on our farm. Our farm primarily consists of Class 3 and Class 4 soils. but is yet still considered high-value farmland under the state's rules. Parts of our so-called high-value farmland are difficult to produce, even to break even. A primary reason why we and other farmers have decided to pursue development of solar facilities on our land is simply to enhance financial health and sustainability of the overall farm operation. We're trying to stay in business, ultimately to pass our farm into the next generation. Solar is one tool that will help us be able to do so. As you know, farming has good years and bad years. Seems like more bad years than good years. Farm income is subject to many factors that are completely out of our control, and these factors have impacts on our operation. By using a small portion of our land for solar is simply diversifying a piece of our income and land with the, and which will ultimately allow us to better weather the bad years and enhance the sustainability and the longevity of our remaining farming operation. Our farm has installed several small solar panels over the past few years and already seeing the benefits of it. We have it's a steady income with very little impact to our land. We have placed these solar panels in corners of fields next to structures where they have the least amount of impact to our farming. Any changes in the current rules could result in permitting processes that may remove the farmer's ability to place solar projects on our property and take away one of the few tools that are available to diversify a small portion of our operation. We urge the committee to simply leave the rules as they are. It seems to be working now. Why change it?
Okay, thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Clem, Representative Witt. My name is Damian Hall. I'm a land use attorney with the law firm of Ball Janik. I'm here on behalf of my client Cypress Creek Renewables today. Thanks for hanging in there with us. I'll try and hit my points quickly. I also submitted written testimony via email so you can see what I have to say in more detail. A couple points. This bill, House Bill 3050, seems to be a fix looking for a problem, and it raises a couple of issues. One, it's at odds with the state's renewable portfolio targets. The second is that it's at odds with the state's existing solar rules, which are relatively new. And finally, it's ambiguous as written. So quickly on the portfolio targets, as you're aware, just in the 2016 session, the legislature passed SB 1547, increasing the portfolio targets for both Pacific Core and PGE up to 8% of what they need to generate needs to come from small-scale renewable sources, and that's less than 20 megawatt solar projects is primarily what that is. There's some other ways to do it, but solar is the main route to go. This is intended to House Bill 3050, in contrast, is intended to increase the difficulty and uncertainty around siting solar projects on high-value farmland. PGE's territory, in particular, the vast majority of it is high-value farmland. So passing this bill would cause a lot of uncertainty as to whether or not those portfolio targets could be met. As I mentioned, there are rules in place that are not being discussed here, and I think it's important to know the context of what is in place that you would be changing if you did move this bill forward, which we encourage you not to. It's not as though it's a free-for-all on high-value farmlands. The existing rules were adopted through a rulemaking process by DLCD and LCDC that brought together numerous stakeholders, state, local, federal government, farming and ranching interests, as well as solar development interests, as well as 1,000 Friends who was at the table in that. And those rules were created in 2011. that process, you know, took a year, had many public meetings, and ultimately resulted in a compromise and has a number of standards that protect high-value farmland. For example, there are acreage limitations on projects on high-value farmland. Solar projects are limited to 12 acres. They have to. There are regulations that require that these projects be located on the least productive soils on any high-value farm tract. So, as Marty was saying, put it on the rocky soil, so you end up seeing proposals that are pushed up against the road on less viable portions of a farm. There's also standards that say that the entirety of the farm tract that's not the 12 acres has to remain in farm use and in commercial operation and can't be impacted by the solar farms. There's also standards that say the solar farm can't impact the farm uses and practices on surrounding parcels. There's even higher thresholds for instances where there are where there would be, because none of these exist yet. These thresholds haven't been triggered. But if there were clustered or co-located projects so that there were more than 48 acres and within any given 1 mile radius, which is about 2,200 acres, then it would have to project would have to demonstrate that together those collected projects don't materially alter the stability of the overall land use pattern of the area. So these issues that are being raised as the reason for having House Bill 3050 have already been addressed through a thoughtfully through an open process and thoughtfully crafted rules that are applicable. Again, the impacts that are being identified by the supporters of this bill are hypothetical at this point. Since 2011, approximately 50 acres of solar uses have been developed in the Willamette Valley. There have been additional applications that have been approved for approximately 200 acres. To put that into context, that's 250 acres out of about 1.8 million acres of high-value farmland. So we're talking well under less than half of 1%. Even smaller than that, 0.0014% of the high-value farmland. That's not the type of proliferation.
Wrap it up.
Yeah, yep. And then if you do move, have interest in this, it's overbroad and ambiguous. So right now we don't know what the test is, and there's a whole lot of things that we could poke holes in as the operation of House Bill 3050, so it would need to be amended if you want to move it forward.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And we will be back to House Bill 3050, so I'm going to carry over House Bill 3050, and we'll be back to it on Thursday. Close the public hearing, House Bill 3050, carry over the public hearing in House Bill 3050, and thank you, Representative Witt, for sticking with us.
Absolutely.
And adjourn the committee.
Thank you.